And hello, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
Yes, and can you tell I'm diseased? My voice is...
That's right. I have a suspicion that by the end of the episode, mine might start sounding like that, too, because I'm feeling a little... Note that bug.
Yeah, note to anyone using this booth after us that there have been diseased people in here, so there you go. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies and to spread disease. But the new movie this week will be the sci-fi action movie Ready Player One. That is in the back half of the show for the first half. This week, because we're talking about a Spielberg movie, we're going to talk about Spielberg movies in the broader contextual filmography sense. Now, if you're a movie fan of a certain age, it's hard to imagine that there is such a thing as life at the cinema without Steven Spielberg. He is kind of ubiquitous with cinema post, I guess, maybe 1975, ever since Jaws. He's a brand name unto himself. And... So, you know, we wanted to talk about, like, the best of Spielberg, and the thing about doing that is, you know, you maybe end up with the same list of about, if you're doing a top five, the same list of about three or four or five movies. So when we began this, planning this episode, we wanted to say, like, there's some stuff that's off limits, because it's universally recognized as the best. You don't find a lot of people saying Jaws is one of Spielberg's worst, or E.T.
I know a person who says that, but...
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. There's always one. Jaws, we took off the list. Raiders of the Lost Ark, we took off the list. E.T., we took off the list. And I think those were the ones we had in common. Mm-hmm. I also took Schindler's List off the list. And we also had Close Encounters in common, I think.
Yeah, that's certainly... Okay,
okay, so those were my five. Then you had, instead of Schindler, you had Jurassic Park as a substitution, which... Yep. I think a lot of people would agree is one of the best. I'm not actually one of them, but I can certainly see why people would appreciate Jurassic Park. But so those movies are kind of off the table. So to begin with, because my voice is on the precipice here, Candace, why don't you start off with your number one of the alternative five Spielberg movies?
Well, so what's interesting and what I found is that once we sort of took those films off the list, it actually made my list pretty short if we're talking about Spielberg-directed films.
Mm-hmm. Are you about to cheat?
Well, I'm definitely going to cheat on a few because I do think that you say, you know, Spielberg is ubiquitous, and I think that part of the reason he's ubiquitous and people don't necessarily realize it is because he executive produced about three times as many things as he ever directed.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, I don't want to say a heavy hand, but he has a very strong hand on some of the things that he directed.
Ask Toby Hooper.
Yeah.
Well, so you can't. Toby Hooper's unfortunately gone.
You can't,
gone,
unfortunately, yeah. Yes. As of last year, we lost him. But yeah, so let me start with the ones that are actually in his wheelhouse. Am I allowed to talk about Jurassic Park?
No, go ahead.
All right, let's talk about Jurassic Park. Because I know you say you don't think it's necessarily one of his best. And I think that there's probably, certainly when you hold it up to E.T. and Raiders and that sort of stuff, it is definitely... not the same caliber. Well, I don't know if it's not the same caliber, but what it definitely did was just introduce an entire new style of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the special effects in Jurassic Park were just mind-blowing for the time, and still pretty good for now, primarily because he didn't just use CGI. He did certainly use CGI, and he used it quite a lot, but he used it really judiciously and also had a lot of models and puppets and stuff as well. So when you got up close, you could still see real sort of features and dimensions on these dinosaurs. So I do think, like, Jurassic Park was, you know, like I say, it sort of brought in the new era of computer-generated images while doing it in a way that still made it palatable. Because I don't know that we've ever gotten better, really, at CGI than most. Like, you know, it's just, I find CGI is so... I think we're there. We're never going to get any better. It's clearly not real. And I don't think that we're ever going to make it so good that it is real. So this is the great way to do it, where you have a little bit of that and a little bit of the puppets as well.
The CG T-Rex in Jurassic World, probably, if you probably line them up side by side with the CG T-Rex from Jurassic Park, there's probably not too much difference.
No. Yeah.
Okay, so Jurassic Park's here first. I'm going to do the mandatory Indiana Jones pick. So with Raiders out, I went with Temple of Doom. And it's funny talking about Temple of Doom, which is, I think at the time was a disappointing sequel to a lot of people. And it's funny to talk about the week The Last Jedi comes out on Blu-ray, which is also to many people a disappointing sequel. But I think also for the same reasons, because it was delivering things people weren't expecting. There were a lot of high expectations coming off the first movie, but the filmmakers, in this case Spielberg, with obviously large creative influence from George Lucas, decided to go in a different direction. They took a step back. They went, if the Raiders takes place in 1936, and Temple of Doom takes place in 1935, and it's not Indiana Jones as he was in Raiders, he's... much more conceited, much more selfish. He's in it for fortune and glory, which is a line straight up from the film. And he's kind of a seedier character. And the film is darker, but that was also because Spielberg and Lucas were going through dark personal stuff. They were both going through divorces at the time. Yeah. So they were not in happy moods, let's say. And, yeah, I mean, there's... You could certainly debate like the borderline racist stuff in it, but you know, chilled monkey brains, for instance. But you know, that talk about pushing the limit, man. But that scene, you could see the like, you can feel the shudders of the MPAA people from watching that movie 30 years later. But it's dark. It's like got child slavery, human sacrifice. But it's bold. And when you go back and look at the two Indiana Jones movies that came later, they both leaned very much into what made Raiders a success. And I feel like Spielberg and Lucas could not, they felt like they could not be bold like that when it came to sequel filmmaking again, that they were just turning too many people off. It's nice that people have kind of refound Temple of Doom, including me. I mean, I was a kid when it came out and obviously wasn't a fan of because it was all the darker stuff in it. But, you know, coming back to it later in life, I found infinitely rewarting. And I think one of John Williams' best scores, too.
Well, interestingly, I think people our age, I feel like people our age at the time probably enjoyed Temple of Doom more because of Short Round.
Right. Yeah.
We had a character that was us. And it was like, oh my God, I'm on this adventure with Indiana Jones.
Short Round was a Mary Sue before there was a Mary Sue.
Yeah. At least that's how I felt when I watched it.
Sure, no.
And my brother and I watched it, and we felt like, you know, we could be part of it because there was a character there identified as us.
Yeah. Okay. Next pick.
All right. Certainly my newest Spielberg film... Catch Me If You Can. So I don't know if it's just my age, nostalgia, if it's Steven Spielberg's age, I'm not sure, but I find that his films are very heavy now, dealing with really, really heavy things, you know, Schindler's List, which we've taken off the table, which was a fantastic film, and I saw it once, and I mean, it's an amazing film. I don't necessarily need to see it more times. Band of Brothers,
also,
right?
3 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah. But, you know, he's just dealing with these really heavy topics and doing a very good job of it. So it was so refreshing when Catch Me If You Can came out, which was just this fun romp through, you know, sort of like the Short Round thing, right? We could all watch this film and watch Leonardo DiCaprio's character getting to play out all of our own personal fantasies and dreams. And, oh, wouldn't it be great to be a pilot? Wouldn't it be great to do this? And, and it was so fun and refreshing. And it felt like the Steven Spielberg I remembered from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. No, I like Catch Me If You Can a lot. That's another great John Williams score, like the 60s kind of funky blues kind of score. It had a great opening, too. And yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio is great. Tom Hanks is also really great in it.
Yeah.
And Amy, early Amy Adams.
Yes.
that's
right.
Try saying that three times fast. Yeah, and Christopher Walken and that relationship between him and Leonardo DiCaprio as father and son was really great.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm not wrong, I think that that was based on a book. And I feel like this is a theme that Steven Spielberg does a lot.
Well, it's also based on a real guy.
Well, yeah. But I don't think the movie was based on the guy. I think the movie was based on
the book,
though. Yeah. And, you know, this seems to be something that Steven Spielberg does quite well, typically. I don't want to give any spoilers about the second half of this. But typically, he does a pretty good job of taking a book. And then, granted, I didn't read this book, but certainly, you know, Jaws, which we took off the table, is a book that it's nothing like the movie.
Right.
But it's so good. So I don't know if this book is as fun and as much of a romp as the movie is.
Well, speaking of books turned into movies, my second pick is Lincoln, which was based on the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, A Team of Rivals, which looked at the Lincoln administration as a whole. But the movie, it's interesting what he does is he takes the last 4 months with the passing of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. And it's also a very honest portrayal of Honest Abe, who was not afraid to use less than honest tactics to get this passed, although he kept his hands fairly clean through most of the process. But like all the patronage appointments and all this wheeling and dealing and horse training to get the necessary votes to ratify the amendment. And also the fact that he was keeping his son out of war, out of the Civil War, and then in year five and... you know, it was, I mean, there's inferred that a lot of it was on the basis for the mental health of Mary Todd Lincoln, who had already lost a son, not to war, but through sickness. And really great cast, you know, a lot of people in small parts, but really great. Michael Stuhlbarg is in it.
He's just solid in everything.
Yeah, he's a treasure. Lee Pace, Jared Harris as Ulysses Grant. I would love to see a Ulysses Grant movie starring Jared Harris. I'm not sure if that's in the that's in the works, but David Strathairn, Tim Blake Nelson, they're all great. It's a really tightly told story. I wish he had stopped like 5 minutes before the end credits, because we don't need to see the death of Lincoln. And it ends with Lincoln on his deathbed, and then it shows one of it. I think it was his second inaugural speech, but the way it should have ended was when he, after they pass the amendment, and he's having a meeting with his advisors, and he's like, "Well, I'm off to the theater, although I would much rather stay." And I think that was perfect enough, because we all know what happens down at the theater, and seeing, you know, the little Lincoln, like, you know, scream in horror when the person comes out and announces that the president's been shot. That was unnecessary, but the rest of and Daniel Day-Lewis too deserves mention, because he was an amazing Lincoln, really great performance.
Yeah, see, I skipped that movie because I'd already seen Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter, and I figured I knew everything I needed to know.
Say what you want about Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, the book is very solid. The book is a solid Lincoln bio with vampire tangents.
With vampires. All right. Yeah. So my next pick, coming back to Indiana Jones, Last Crusade. You know, frankly, I really don't know what popular opinion is about this movie, and I don't really care. I really enjoyed it. For me, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark obviously is a very good film. Again, sort of similar to Jurassic Park, right? It kind of set a tone and created kind of I feel like even more than like Jaws or Close Encounters, it really made Spielberg a thing and created that whole Amblin Entertainment, just was like this groundbreaking thing. Last Crusade is the one I'm more likely to turn on, though, because it's fun. It's got Sean Connery. I mean, it's got this great dynamic with Sean Connery and Harrison Ford, which is just, you know, well worth the price of admission. And on top of that, despite my atheism, I am a bit of a sucker for Catholic mysticism.
Yeah.
And this is just rife with it. I mean, so was Raiders, but this is even more so, right? The search for the Holy Grail, all the tests. It was just a really fun puzzle movie,
mm-hmm.
right? I feel like, you know, Drake Uncharted is like a version of that that you can play.
Yeah, no, and I think Last Crusade is that fun movie. I have a particularly personal fondness for it because me and my dad saw it in theaters, and it was like on the last day it was in the theater. Mm-hmm. And it was just the two of us in the theater.
Yeah.
So that, you know, there's a personal sentimentality for me for mm-hmm. that one. And yeah, you're right. It's just fun. It doesn't try to reinvent the wheel. It's just a good time. It's just, you know, it's just solid entertainment, which is, you know, mm-hmm. Spielberg at his finest. It just is able to deliver so easily. I'm going to.
Are you cheating?
No. I don't cheat on.
Come on, I'm
I let
gonna
other
cheat.
People cheat on these lists because everyone else is a cheater. I don't cheat, but I'm going with 2002's Minority Report, which is fun. I think it's again solid action, and of course, you know, if you have Tom Cruise in there, he is an expert at solid mm-hmm. action. Still to this day, even though he's like in his mid-70s now, I don't know.
I don't know.
still, you know, that deal with Xenu is really keeping him together. But mm-hmm. It's got a lot. It's got so many fancy futuristic details, and it's funny to read about how Spielberg gathered like futurists. He got like a group of futurists together and said, okay, tell me what the 2050s will look like. And actually some of it's come to pass, including retinal readers and fingerprint mm-hmm. ID.
A little bit faster than touch screen.
Yeah. And even driverless cars. It's, you know, we're really all that's kind of left is precogs and hover cars, and boom, we're there.
Some might say there are already precogs.
Excellent point. Learn more about that on our InfoWars podcast. But yeah, another great cast. And Samantha Morton is a highlight in that one as the precog Agatha. And there's this really great scene that has nothing to do with the action at all, but it's so haunting, where the Tom Cruise character and his ex-wife, their son died, which is one of the reasons he's a pre-crime police officer. And she's explaining what their dead son's life would be like if he had lived. Mm-hmm. And it is, and she's like just describing snippets of it. And it's so sad, and it's so bittersweet, and it's so well delivered by Samantha Morton, and it's heartbreaking. And yeah, it's a really nice little quiet scene, which again, you know, Spielberg is known as the action guy, but these like little small character moments, these intimate character moments, he can be really, really good at as well. Mm-hmm. Even amongst a big action picture like Minority Report.
Yeah, and I do think that really is what sets Spielberg apart from other other directors, is bringing in that family aspect mm-hmm. and those quiet moments, you know, the dynamic between father and son or mother and daughter or whatever. And now it's time for me to start cheating. And so this is when I am going to talk about Poltergeist.
Okay.
Poltergeist is an interesting film because there was always controversy over how much Spielberg had to do with mm-hmm. the directing. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that he directed the film. I do believe that Toby Hooper directed it.
Mm-hmm.
However, you can see so much Spielberg in it, even right down to the cinematography style and all of that. So first mm-hmm. of all, you've got this family, which, you know, you look at Jaws, at Close Encounters, at E.T., it's all stories about family mm-hmm. and how they interact, what they're trying to get away from each other, or what they're trying to go towards with each other. And Poltergeist is just this really strong family story about what a mother is willing to do for her kids, right? And so you get that sort of family thing, but then the cinematography style with all the particularly the second half, right? When things really start going a little wacky in the house, all the lights and the, you know, it's so reminiscent of Close Encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it's so reminiscent now of the current directors who are totally taking that style, right? When you look at J.J. Abrams, when you look at the Duffer Brothers doing the Stranger yeah. Things, right? That, like, you know, Super 8 and Stranger Things are so Spielberg. And to me, it's just like, it looks like they're just blending E.T. and Poltergeist to get to, you know, whatever that It's So Spielberg means, to me means E.T. crossed with Poltergeist.
which we're shooting at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Poltergeist is interesting because I do see a lot of Toby Hooper in it. But of course, Toby Hooper himself said that I think somebody asked him about Spielberg and did he really direct Poltergeist? And Toby Hooper said something to the effect of, well, if you mean by directing, like the producer comes in, sets up the cameras, tells the actors what to do, and then lets me call action. Yeah, I directed it. But I think there's probably a degree of bitterness because I think Spielberg hasn't really been like a direct producer like that ever. He's got producer credits, but it's never been like hands-on like that ever since, and certainly not anything he's written. He hasn't written much, but he hasn't had that kind of dual role where it's been written and produced by. It's kind of either one or the other. So yeah, that's an interesting one. Mm-hmm. For my fourth pick, I chose Munich. Which is another one of these serious ones that Candace doesn't want to talk about.
I didn't even want to watch it, to be fair.
Yeah, it's tense. It's, again, there's another great scene in it, oddly enough, involving a child, where they're trying to kill one of the people behind the Munich attack, and it's in a Parisian apartment, and the girl goes to school. I think she goes to school, but the guy's all alone in his apartment, so they're getting ready to blow it up. But the little girl comes back because she's forgotten something, so they have to call it off quick because they're obviously not going to kill a kid. And that's like maybe the most tense moment is the call not to kill someone. And I was reading kind of like some criticism that, you know, it's maybe a bit too simplistic and that he tries to equate, you know, the PLO with the Mossad tactics here. But I mean, there's a line straight up in the movie where Eric Bana is the lead Mossad agent is getting instructions. And he's told, like, well, the terrorists don't have a state, so now neither do you, which is fairly straightforward. But speaking of Spielberg endings, the end of this one is after the operation is over and the Bana character is like disillusioned and he's immigrated to America. And so him and his handler, played by Jeffrey Brush, meet up in, I think it's somewhere in Long Island and somewhere in Queens, and it's along the shoreline. And they have this conversation about what they accomplished, and everyone that has been killed has been replaced by, you know, someone who's worse. And Jeffrey Rush kind of flippantly says, well, you know what? I cut my toenails, but they grow back. It's, you know, it really kind of boils down the geopolitics of the situation. Of course, they both walk away, and there in the center of the screen is the two towers of the World Trade Center. And it's, I mean, in a lot of, when Spielberg does a lot of this, and he did it in The Post too, and we did it in Lincoln when we talked about it, a lot of times he kind of ham-fist the message, but I felt this one was just right, that just letting those two towers sit there in the center of the screen as a fade to black, that was good enough. I didn't, you know, we don't need a coda, we don't need to have it, our hands held, as he explained, well, it's still going on, right? So, yeah, Munich.
Yeah. I don't know, it's still not really on my list of films to see.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think I've made myself very clear on this show in the past that I really like going to see things that just take me away from real life. So now I'm just straight up cheating on this one.
Okay,
but I'm going to tie it back in. So,
okay, good.
Executive producer Steven Spielberg. Everybody knows about Band of Brothers. I think fewer people know about this incredible, incredible, I think 10 or 13 part series called Taken.
Oh yeah.
Which was amazing. I loved every second of it. Mm-hmm. We recorded it off the television and rewatched it over and over again. This is Dakota Fanning's the first time she was ever, you know, she was just this like, who is this child in this film? So, now, to be fair, I haven't rewatched it in ages, so I can't quite remember exactly. You know, I feel like it's one of those things where I'm like, where do we get it? Is it on Netflix? Is it on Crave TV?
That's a great
question. I want to watch something. Yeah. I got to watch this again because it was so good. But it's the more my style Spielberg, aliens, you know, aliens come, they take people, they bring them back. There's just these mysteries. Nobody really knows who's going, you know, it's just a mystery, giant mystery.
Yep.
Dakota Fanning, her first thing, I think she must have been like 6 or 7 mm-hmm. in this. Obviously, she did such a great job in this role that She then went on to star in War of the Worlds right after this, which was, you know, also Spielberg done.
Yep.
So I tied it back. I mean, he was the executive producer on this. And that's the thing, right? Similarly, you know, his executive producer credits, I think, particularly on these sort of miniseries type things, it's very clear that it's a Spielberg joint.
This War of the Worlds, I still can't believe the sun survived. Anyway, my last pick is, again, keeping it serious, is Amistad, and it's kind of overlooked because it was sandwiched between the Jurassic Park sequel and Saving Private Ryan. It's interesting because it's, again, it's some people rail. It's kind of simplistic, the story, and it's like, well, it's a movie. It's in, you know, you can't really cram the whole bloody 400-year history of slavery into a 2.5-hour movie. But it's also interesting to watch to see how Spielberg had progressed as a director in the 12 years between this and The Color Purple, which I would call a noble failure, even though Spielberg, I don't think, was in a place to deal with a lot of this seriousness, the misogyny and the violence and the sexual violence in The Color Purple. But this, he shows slavery for all its ugliness, and it is so ugly. And I think Anthony Hopkins was nominated for an Oscar for playing John Quincy Adams, but the real star of this is Jimin Hounsou as the... I guess he's like a kind of appointed as the spokesperson for the slaves of the rebel slaves of the Amistad. And he is, I think it's his first big role, and he is so great. And I don't think he's really got a chance like this to shine again. Usually he's like the heavy in movies. He's like a villain or a co-villain role, like in, you know, Furious 7 or Guardians of the Galaxy or any of those. But he's so good and so quiet in the role. And you see the movie through him, and he's really, really good. And that, again, that's Spielberg's talent working with actors. And I think it's a very rewarding film. I think it's even more rewarding now than it was at the time. Mm-hmm. And that has a lot to do with the politics of modern day, which some of us would rather not deal with, admittedly. Mm-hmm. But there you go. So we're going to take a break here and talk about the latest Steven Spielberg movie, which is Ready Player One. Until then, here's a bit of music. It takes something old and makes it new again, which is kind of in the theme, the ballpark of Ready Player One. At least I hope. And you'll recognize the music when you hear it. So enjoy. And we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
It's a place where the limits of reality are your own imagination. People come to the Oasis for all the things they can do, but they stay because of all the things they can be. I'm here talking to all of you now because our future's being threatened.
Go, go, go! I just came here to escape. But I found something much bigger than myself. I found my friends.
What up, Z?
I found love. And now, people have lost their lives.
No.
This is war for control of the future.
Find him.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
And that was a scene from Ready Player One. It is a new film from Steven Spielberg, and it stars Ty Sheridan, Olivia Cooke, Ben Mendelsohn, Lena Waithe, Simon Pegg, and Mark Rylance. What can be said? I mean, it's based on the novel by Ernest Cline.
Yeah.
It's a very well thought of novel to people of a certain age, and I think we are in that age group. Mm-hmm. I have not read it myself, so I want to start with you because you have read it.
Yeah, I have read it.
So, your thoughts.
So, to put it quite simply, the book Ready Player One by Ernest Cline was written by a geek in his 40s for geeks in their 40s. Right. So it leaned heavily into late 70s, early 80s video gaming, a little bit of role play, a little bit of like pop culture, movies, music, but most heavily into video games, which, of course, if you remember video games from the late 70s and the early 80s, side scrolling, if you're lucky, you know, like Space Invaders,
asteroids,
mm-hmm. yeah, like Pac-Man. Single screen sort of thing, yeah. So this movie, however, I don't know who it was made by. I know Ernest Cline is given a screenplay credit along with Zach Penn, mm-hmm. so presumably made by geeks in their 40s and Spielberg, so is in his 60s or something. But as far as I'm concerned, made for teens and 20-year-olds. Mm. It's made for the Twitch generation. It is not made for us whatsoever.
Mm. It's interesting.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just...
No.
I don't think it's going to do well because the people who are going to want to see it are people... like it's... the movie does not deliver on the nostalgia and love and promise of the book.
What that's interesting because I think it over delivers on that.
I think it over delivers on a lot of stuff that is not necessary, but
because something I was thinking about was Simon Pegg's in this, and mm-hmm. I was making my notes for this, and I was thinking about, you know, Simon Pegg is, what is Simon Pegg known for, or what did he get famous for? He got famous for the Cornholio trilogy, so Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End. And the thing those movies really do very, very well is they take, you know, Shaun of the Dead, mm-hmm. like the Romero films, you know, zombie films in general, Hot Fuzz with... Point Break and Bad Boys 2 and all these ridiculous action films, takes all the things that make those movies them, and is able to reinterpret them in new ways mm-hmm. and exciting ways and ways that make you go, oh, I recognize that, but I'm enjoying this as for what it is. I'm not enjoying Hot Fuzz because it takes on Bad Boys 2 and Britishizes it a bit. I'm enjoying it because it's Hot Fuzz and it's hilarious. I think that's what's missing in this. It's just like, here's the Batmobile from Batman 66, and here's Freddy Krueger, and here's the Iron Giant, and it's just throwing all, like the Back to the Future car, and just throwing all this paraphernalia at you with, I guess to the point just to sell you on, like, hey, do you remember this? And it's...
which is exactly what the book does,
right.
But it does it in a different way. So I feel like Steven Spielberg was always the wrong person to direct this film.
Yeah.
I think people our age, like this is a J.J. Abrams or a Denis Villeneuve sort of thing, right? The people who, because Steven Spielberg was such a part of creating that pop culture that he can't Metacritic it. Like he just can't. He can't look at it fondly with nostalgia and this love and, you know, adoration because he's looking at himself.
Yeah.
He's never going to see himself and the products that he created with the same love and adoration that we do. He can't, like, he just can't deliver. So where, you know,
it would be like Romero making Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah. So where we just spent all this time talking about his films of the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and how he has that familial relationship, and there's always these meaningful, deep, quiet moments.
Mm-hmm.
He can't bring that to something that's essentially putting him on a throne. He's just the wrong person for this film, for one thing.
And it's also not, it doesn't feel like a Spielberg film.
No.
And I don't know if it's because there's, like, so much going on, because he does try to have these quiet moments, and they just kind of fall flat, and there's a scene where Wade meets Artemis in the real world, and they're kind of up on the roof of this building, and he's like, oh, I forgot how quiet it is. Yeah. It's supposed to be like this little quiet introspective scene where he's trying to make the point that, you know, the Oasis, interesting, timely enough, when you have, you know, people who help create Facebook and Google mm-hmm. coming out and saying, like, our products are kind of addicting and kind of destroying society. So he's trying to sell this message, and it can't, because the focus of the movie is on what goes on in the Oasis with mm-hmm. all the nostalgia and all the world building and all the action. And there's a full-on battle sequence in the climax of the film. Mm-hmm. And it kind of bothered me, it didn't take me long to figure out why. But it's because Spielberg doesn't do big battle sequences.
No.
There's one, Private Ryan.
Yep.
And it's at the beginning, and it's to make the point of how horrid D-Day was. And he's done, like, little battle things, like Lincoln begins with a Civil War battle. The Post begins with a little Vietnam battle. But he does not do battle sequences. He can add it for, like, color, for context, but he does not do battle sequences. Mm-hmm. And the last half hour of this is, like, one giant video game battle with machines and AT-ATs and Iron Giants and catapults and shields and
Well, and that's what I mean. Like, this film is made for the Twitch generation, because basically while you're watching it, you are watching a video game, because it's mm-hmm. that mocap style of CGI, which mm-hmm. is not remotely what I want to see to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But so everything looks like you're watching a commercial for the next you know, who knows what game coming out.
Kingdom Hearts or something, where that's a game very much built on here's this Easter egg and that Easter egg.
And so what's really interesting here, so I have read the book, and somehow this movie, while and I was actually surprised by the time, 2 hours and 20 minutes, because it didn't feel like it, because it was so action-packed. I felt like, you know, sure, there were those moments in between getting from one place to the next, and like a 30-minute. You're right. The last battle scene was way too long, but I didn't really like. I wasn't sitting there going, "Oh my gosh, why am I still doing in this theater?" But somehow they managed to make a 2-hour and 20-minute movie based on a book without putting any of the character development from the book into it, any of the world building from the book into it, and basically none of the challenges from the book into it. Like, somehow it's mind-blowing to me. I'm like, what did someone just sort of give a short synopsis of what the book was about, and then they just made everything up?
I
do find it interesting, though, because the only part of the film that I enjoyed, coming back to this, Spielberg can't create a nostalgic, you know, love story about his own work because it's his, is that second challenge, which is like totally like it came out of nowhere. However, what it is a nostalgic love story about Spielberg's favorite director,
Kubrick.
Right? I know. Yeah. And so that was the only part of the movie that I laughed, that I enjoyed.
That was the best sequence, the Shining sequence.
It was totally like inappropriate for that. Like, I was just like, I don't even know where this is even coming from. This is not, it doesn't even follow with the story. They're really just like jamming it in there somehow. But it was the only scene that actually worked.
Yeah, it was well edited. There were lots of great laughs. There was, you know, character development. You know, and it showed, it also played with the material from the twins. And the funny part is the one character, I can't remember.
Doesn't like
which
H.
one?
H.
Yeah,
that's
like right.
Horror movies.
He doesn't, doesn't like horror movies. And so when he sees the twins and he's like, oh, wait, where are you guys going? And they're like, no, don't go near the elevators. Go near the elevators. It was so perfect.
And then he finally gets into a room. He's like, thank God. And he runs into a room and slams the door. And
it's
room 237. I audibly laughed. It was the only time I made a noise the whole time, except besides going, oh, God, this movie.
That sequence was really, and of course, it deconstructs the sequence too, because, you know, they go into the ballroom where there's the ghost dancing, and it speaks to the character, the main character, not the main character, but the character Holiday, who created the Oasis, and some of his interference. Because the rest of the time, it's just like, okay, so this character was like a shut-in weirdo that just liked playing video games. You know, there's nothing really interesting there. you know, especially there's a blatant comparison to for him to Jobs, Steve Jobs, mm-hmm. in the movie. Yep. And it's like, well, you go watch the Steve Jobs movie, and I understand that that may not be 100% factual, but mm-hmm. you see a deeply flawed
yep.
character who is able to be an inspiration, but while still being a complete and utter jackass
yeah.
in that movie. And you can understand where it comes from both sides. And Mark Rylance, although incredible, mm-hmm. I love Mark Rylance, and the last scene he's in, is he's so great in it.
Yep.
But there's nothing to Halliday that is particularly yeah. understandable or relatable, even to pop culture obsessed shut-ins, I think.
So what I think is interesting, so in the book, Halliday's character is very much Jobs, and mm-hmm. and actually his character is kind of different in the book, and is very clearly Jobs, is not quite so socially inept, not quite so reserved and quiet, and is ultimately he actually is sort of the mastermind of getting his partner Ogden Morrow out, mm-hmm. and then regrets that decision.
Mm.
In the movie, it did not seem like something that was actually like planned or done. It was just, yeah. you know, so in the book, you can definitely see the parallel mm. through the Steve Jobs. In the movie, that none of that is there. And I don't believe that they're trying to make him Steve Jobs-esque in the movie.
Right.
And there are people who believe that it's a little more Lucas-like. He's a little more George Lucas,
mm-hmm.
who is very quiet and reserved, speaks softly and slowly. And,
That's
you know,
interesting. Still didn't work.
You're right. I mean, it totally.
Because you're right.
Nothing in this
you know,
film worked.
Yeah, hearing you say that, it does. The parallels become yeah. more obvious. Between Halliday and Morrow, it's very much Jobs and Wozniak.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you know, I wonder what the decision was there to sort of round those edges. One character I did like was Mendelsohn as the bad guy. Because
yeah.
There's something about him that felt so like Ronnie Cox in RoboCop, which made me wonder mm-hmm. why there was no Ed 209s protecting the final challenge, because that would have been too heavy-handed. But there were a couple of scenes where it felt like Mendelsohn was channeling Ronnie Cox in RoboCop. The kind of typical 80s, you know, corporate baron, cutthroat business type in a, you know, a bespoke suit. And yeah, he was really good. And I love there's a scene where he's trying to negotiate with Wade, and he's having to be fed all these references in his ears because he does not care about, but you know, he's in the challenge to basically control like the next level of advertising.
Yeah.
Again, kind of a real world analogy yeah. there. But I thought he was great. So it's, I think the older actors, like Simon Pegg, I thought mm-hmm. he didn't have a lot to do, but he was
well, and his character had a lot more to do in the book, and I was disappointed that mm-hmm. it's just like, and then they just sort of throw in like, oh, he was actually, I don't know, do we want to spoil it? Don't go see it. Let's just, believe me, save your money.
He was kind of the puppet master the whole time. That was a bit bizarre. Yeah.
In the book, he had a bigger role. But Daito and Sho, the two Japanese characters, I certainly remember when I was reading the book that to me they were the most fascinating, because they really talked a little bit about the Japanese culture and the spirit, like that, you know, the ghost in the machine, the fact that
that's another 80s thing.
In Japanese spirituality, they believe that, you know, inanimate objects also have spirits. And so this whole thing of like, now you're going into this game and who's like, who's real and who's a spirit. And there was also in the book, Daito died, like in mm-hmm. real life, was totally killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really moving moment and it meant a lot.
Mm.
And they're just like, I don't know. Are
they
just
the shaft,
racial
yeah.
color in this film? Like,
that's what I felt. Yeah, because even H, who in real life, H in the game, is like this hulking sort of cybernetic monster thing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in real life, H is Helen, you know, a young black woman. And, it, you know, speaks to, you know, it's kind of teased earlier in the film. If you don't, mm-hmm. if you're not coming into the movie with the knowledge of the book like I am, where they're talking about Artemis and And it's like, well, she could be, you know, a 300-pound guy named Chuck in yeah. real life. And, you know, so it kind of telegraphs it, which is, you know, a fascinating bit. You know, when your life is, when your real life is kind of what's happening in the game mm-hmm. and how to project yourself. Again, that also reminds me of The Matrix. I think it was the Wachowskis' plan mm-hmm. to make the character switch in the first mm-hmm. Matrix transgender, in that she was a female in the real world, and then when she jacks into the Matrix, right. she's a male.
Yeah.
so, you know, that would have been something very interesting to explore, but it's mm-hmm. kind of almost turned into a joke.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting is because the book, so a lot of the people who talk about the book negatively, mm-hmm. Some, you know, basically, like, it's not high art. This is a beach read, right? Like, it's a guilty pleasure. It doesn't take a lot of work to read. It's just a fun, much like Catch Me If You Can. It's a fun romp through.
You should be Ernest Cline's editor.
It's a fun romp through our childhood. And that's how I approached it. But then mm-hmm. there are other people who really sort of read a little more deeply into the subtext of it and feel that, you know, this is just another white geek boy, you know, who yeah. is the chosen one, who suddenly feels like he's so important and is the gatekeeper for all of these things. Because, of course, he knows more than everybody else. He knows more than the woman, Artemis. He mm-hmm. knows more than this. And yet, at the same time, while people say that, and you know, fairly rightly, about the book, there are these things about these other cultures, these Japanese cultures, which was, you know, it could have been more deeply developed in the book, but totally thrown away for the movie. It was certainly, you know, his best friend, H, who ends up being Helen, you know, that's a little more deeply, you yeah. know, talked about in the book. So now I'm just like, okay, so we kind of cleaned up some of the maybe toxic masculinity or the geek culture, the like gatekeeping of geek culture mm-hmm. out of the book and cleaned that up for the movie, but also threw out what could have possibly been actually a more interesting story.
I generally had a problem with Wade. It took me a minute to clue into it, but the problems with Wade as the hero are the same problems with Shia LaBeouf as the hero of the first three Transformer movies, where he's kind of got no animus, where it's kind of like, you know, in the first one, it's all about, I want my car, you know, I'm sick, you know, I'm 16, where's my car? And then the next one, it's like, I want to be at college, I'm at my college, and I don't want to be drawn into this world-ending robot conflict. And then the third one, it's like, oh, well, now I'm a college grad. Give me a raise and give me a commanding role in it, on all of this. And it's just like, just this high expectation.
Haven't earned
anything. Right. And then there's a scene in Ready Player One where after he wins the first challenge, what's the first thing he does? Go shopping. He yeah. buys all this cool suit and buys all these cool accessories. And it's just, it's annoying because yeah. it's like, I realize that this is kind of an artificial world, but if you're trying to, I don't know, tell a story about, you know, the significance of this and what winning this context means, I don't think you go shopping and you after the first victory. And you're right. And there's elements to Artemis. There's a deeper backstory there. Mm-hmm. But she's introduced as the Manic Pixie Dream Girl,
yeah.
which, of course, plays into all that. It's like, you know, we want this cool chick who's awesome at everything and likes the same stuff we like. And, mm-hmm. of course, she will automatically like me if I dress like Buckaroo Banzai, because we both like Buckaroo Banzai because we're both cool like that.
Yeah.
And that just strikes a wrong chord up and down.
Yep.
And but, you know, we're talking about all these references, and I'm wondering, does Spielberg get these things, or is he just kind of like taking the tropes and yeah. the things he's seeing and translating them and thinking, well, that's what's in the book? And
well, and it's interesting because I know there was a documentary, I haven't seen it yet, but about the sort of like trifecta of directors there, Spielberg, Lucas, and someone else.
There's always someone
yeah,
else.
Yeah, who's the third? I don't know. But
De Palma? Scorsese?
Maybe. Scorsese? I don't know. But it's a documentary about these three who spent a lot of time together, worked together a lot. And I was listening to a podcast. They were talking about it and talking about how it was really fascinating to hear all these things and get all these behind-the-scenes stories. But as I'm watching it, I'm becoming increasingly more uncomfortable with the fact that there is not a single woman interviewed on any of the crews. Like, nothing. There's just no women anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that it's okay that you come from a different time, but they definitely came from a time where it's like the Hollywood, it was a, it still is a boys club, but it definitely was a boys club then.
Now there's self-awareness of the boys club.
but you know, when you're in your 60s or 70s and you've been doing this for 40 years, it's really hard to break out of that or to see outside of that. So I don't know that he sees these problems. I don't know that he sees that a manic pixie dream girl isn't actually a real character. It's barely even an archetype. It's just like a crutch, basically.
It's bizarre, and that's no slight against Olivia Cooke, because I think she's better developed than most everybody else. But what the problematic thing too is that she's the only other major female character, and the only other one I was thinking of was Hannah John Kamen, who...
And what was her name? Finale or something?
Yeah, it was like Finale Norton or something.
Yeah, which, it's Finale. I was like, "Is what? This is not a character from the
book. She was invented for the movie. Yeah. And she has a very distinctive look. People might know her from the TV show Killjoys. But she has presence, but she's relegated here to being like this lawyer slash assassin and
the fixer. She just gets things done.
She fixed things. She sometimes fixes them permanently. But all her scenes kind of involved like talking to Medelson about, you know, plotting, you know, people's death and destruction of things and getting rid of people. And it's one of those things that, oh, I forgot Helen. Helen's a woman, but in the thing, she's a monster cyborg. But it's it is problematic that the female voice is a bit relegated. And I wonder what would have happened if this material had been given to not Ernest Cline, who's from his book. I've always considered it problematic when somebody takes a material they've done in one medium and translates it to another, because I feel like they can't be honest about it and look to the Wizarding World and the Fantastic Beasts movies to sort of see another example of that. Then you have Zach Penn, who's been writing a lot of the crappier superhero movies, but also he did... you know, he's kind of knee-deep in this stuff. He did the Netflix movie Atari Game Over, which was about the history of Atari. Ernest Cline was in that as well. So you have all these people who have kind of, like, saturated in this material, and they think they know what's in the book and how to bring that to the surface. And you're absolutely right about, you know, I thought for a minute, what if Paul Verhoeven directed this? Because when you talk about the commerciality of it all.
Troopers again. Oh, right. My God, that was such a great, like, such a satire.
But yeah, but when you talk about undermining the commerciality, and that was certainly a big part of RoboCop. Getting someone who can kind of deconstruct the material and get at to the characters, get out from underneath all the nostalgia and stuff. Because what it just seems like is... nobody's kind of taken the material. I mean, you can say what you want about the 50 Shades movies, but that was E.L. James.
Yeah, yes.
Taking something and then turning it into something else.
Yeah.
And in the Oasis world, nobody's doing that. Everyone's using it straight up. There's a scene where, like, Chucky's used as a weapon, like Chucky from the Child's Play series. The only thing that really kind of made me laugh, because it was unexpected, it was like a... remember Monster Balls?
Yes.
The Monster Balls as a hand grenade.
That's a deep cut. Those Monster Balls.
That was a deep cut. And there was a Gundam scene. It's like kind of like random kind of stuff where there aren't as many Gundam fans as there are Back to the Future fans. Yeah. So, you know, there were things I think they could have done rather than just make this, like, nostalgia shopping, which is like, maybe I'll go and watch Back to the Future when I get home.
Though, I would definitely use a Zemeckis cube to just turn back time and hire someone else to do this film. Do you know what? Actually, I would turn back time and have them not do it. Like, I remember I was a little bit late to reading this book, frankly. So I read this book just 3 years ago and it had already been out for a couple of years and was super popular. And so when I read it, just like as I was reading it or right after was when the news came that it was optioned for a movie. And immediately I just thought, I don't want to see this book as a movie. That's a bad choice. It's just a bad choice to make this into a movie.
I wouldn't agree or disagree, but there was ways to do it. I mean, this could have been a Who Framed Roger Rabbit scenario, where you could have like sort of cherry picked how you use things. You look at Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Spielberg production, by the way. He executive produced that, directed by Robert Zemeckis, who, you know, is all over this movie. But there are cues in here where the nostalgia is used elegantly. There's when he arrives at the end of the first challenge, and there's this, like, band, this invisible band that's doing this, like, John Williams congratulations score that was, I thought, like, that's kind of where I want that to go. Not this, here's this guy, you remember this, here's Jump and Van Halen. It's like, is any kid in the 2040s going to be this obsessed with 80s stuff? I mean,
no.
I don't think so. It's
yeah, I think, you know what, if you are a very big fan of Ready Player One because of the nostalgia factor, just watch season one of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
That's all you need. Don't go see this movie. You won't get what you want from it.
Yeah.
If you are in your 20s and you think that your parents are kind of funny, you know, and you're kind of like, ugh, come on, Mom, why are you listening to this song again?
Yeah.
Go see Ready Player One. You'll enjoy this film.
Yeah. Sometimes we joke on the show, like, kids, ask your parents about, well, this is the movie to, you know. If you don't want to ask your parents, that's fine. Go see Ready Player One.
Yep.
You'll get it.
It's
but it does make me sad because it's so sad to watch Spielberg stumble. It's sad to something like this that has tremendous promise and tremendous opportunity to you know, not understand itself and not really do anything new. And yeah, it could have been something interesting, but it's just something. And I do wonder what I have not seen the box office numbers yet, but I wonder how successful it's going to be. But
well, and to be fair, I don't think. I mean, what are we? The first weekend in April. This is not. I mean, it's not the February dead zone where you drop movies that you kind of just want to go away. But it's certainly not.
Is there a
summer
February
block.
Dead zone?
Not anymore. Not anymore. It seems like February is a pretty good month for films. But
yeah, you're right. Oh, that's too loud. There we go. That's better. Anyway, we got to call it here. This has been your End Credits show for this week. You can find us on endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can find us on social media, Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, and Twitter, End Credits Radio. And I'll be back here Tuesday at 5 for Open Sources Guelph, and that's with Scotty Hertz there. And in the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. Candace?
You can find me everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48, and you can listen to me talk more about pop culture and books and movies on the Village podcast from the Bookshelf, downtown Guelph.
Yeah, this would be a good one for that podcast, too.
Mm-hmm.
You should watch it again.
No, thank you.
Anyway, we'll watch something else for next week, and we'll come back with another episode of End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will see you then.